It's always a pleasure for me to be here at Dhiraj Maharaj's place. I've nicknamed it the Outreach Center for Struggling Vaishnavas. We come here exhausted from our attempts to distribute Krishna consciousness, knowledge. We arrive here with the tailpipes of our cars dragging on the ground, leaking oil, engine misfiring. And then after just a few days here, we become totally enlivened and rejuvenated, especially by Maharaj's Holy Sangha Association, the wonderful prasad, the transcendental ambience, and the gorgeous hospitality. And then, of course, we also get to speak before you all and discuss Krishna. Tonight I thought to speak about something from Chaitanya Charitamrita, but I know this is a very advanced, learned audience due to having so much association with Dhiraj Swami. And I also thought to mix in part of a subject that I developed for speaking at the University of Toronto. I finished a 10-day speaking series there. Programs in the evening, not during the class time, but in the evening. And we had many subjects, the yoga of food, spiritual environmentalism, as Maharaj said, spiritual economics. And one of them was the yoga of money. So since you all are having to deal with maintaining in this world, I thought we could discuss that, a bit of it. <Not all. laughs> Yoga of money. Sometimes it is said that, well, it's very nice what you're saying about Krishna, and all glories to the Krishna Katha. All glories to the talks about Krishna, but meanwhile, in the real world, those of us who have to cope with our real world. So, we'll talk about that today. We'll have some surprising subjects from Chaitanya Charitamrita. Maha Krodha, great anger. Maha Dhana, great wealth. How those two fit together, we shall see. Om Ganitivanandasya Gananjana Shalakya Chakshun Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Guruve Namaha Jai Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhara Sivasati Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. I don't want to deprive them of their benefit they're getting over there. No need of cactus trees getting in the way of the sun. All right. Before we discuss the yoga of money, we should establish what is real wealth. What is the Mahadhana? The great wealth, the topmost wealth. In order to establish our lifestyles properly and orientate ourselves correctly to make the most of our mission of a human form of life, we need to constantly remember what is real wealth, what's the topmost wealth. Let's listen to some instructions that Lord Chaitanya is giving to Sanatan Goswami. We'll go into the 20th chapter of Madhya Lila, and a particular section introduced by Lord Chaitanya. He's saying that when you're properly situated in bhakti and your dormant love for Krishna awakens, then you can actually taste the association of Lord Krishna. You see, Krishna consciousness is about sense objects. All of existence is about sense objects, whether material or spiritual. It's just a question of whether we're dealing with material or spiritual sense objects. Think about that. When we're properly situated in bhakti yoga, we can taste the association of Lord Krishna. This is something that's not theoretical at all. It involves the enlivenment of our real senses. Once you can actually taste the association of Lord Krishna, Lord Chaitanya explains, material existence, bhava, the cycle of repeated birth and death, comes to an end. The cycle of repeated birth and death comes to an end, but that's not the goal of bhakti yoga. It's an auxiliary happening. Lord Chaitanya, to make sure we understand the point, elaborates. The goal of love of Godhead is not to become materially rich or free from material bondage. The real goal is to be situated in devotional service to the Lord and to enjoy transcendental bliss. We like to explain how bhakti yoga is completely 100% an efficient process, in that there's no residue, there's nothing extraneous. The means, 100%, are the end. We are serving Krishna in order to serve Krishna. We are chanting Hare Krishna in order to chant Hare Krishna. The goal of serving Krishna is to serve Krishna. The goal of chanting Hare Krishna is to chant Hare Krishna. So this is the most efficient process. No residues, no leftovers. Everything, 100%, from the means becomes the end. As you know, it's not like you climb a ladder to the roof and then discard the ladder once you're where you want to be. The ladder becomes the roof. Let's hear Srila Prabhupada's purport. The results of devotional service are certainly not material benefits or liberation from material bondage. The goal of devotional service is to be eternally situated in the loving service of the Lord, and to enjoy spiritual bliss from that service. One is said to be in a poverty-stricken condition when one forgets the Supreme Personality of Godhead. One has to end such a life of poverty in order to automatically end the miserable conditions of material existence. One is automatically liberated from material enjoyment when one tastes the service of Krishna. One does not have to endeavor separately for opulence. Opulence automatically comes to the pure devotee, even though he does not desire material happiness. So here we see poverty defined and wealth defined. One is said to be in a poverty-stricken condition when one forgets the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And next, we'll hear Lord Chaitanya talk about real wealth. Mahadana, the supreme treasure. He says, in the Vedic literatures, Krishna is the central point of attraction, and his service is our activity. To attain the platform of love of Krishna is life's ultimate goal. Therefore, Krishna, number one, Krishna's service, number two, and love of Krishna, number three, are the three great riches of life. So here is our wealth program. And our wealth program teaches us how to avoid poverty. A poverty-stricken condition is when we don't have service to Krishna. The more service to Krishna we have, the more opulent and wealthy our life is. This is the standard of Lord Chaitanya. This is the Mahadana, the supreme treasure. That treasure is so precious, engagement in devotional service of the Lord, that a devotee is not even concerned with the four types of liberation, which do automatically come from devotional service. You know those four types of liberation. Sarshti, to share the opulences of the Lord. Salokya, to share the same planet as the Lord. Samipya, to be an associate of the Lord. Sarupya, to have the same form as the Lord. These liberations, the Lord explains to Ambarish Maharaj and Durvasa Muni in the ninth canto. These liberations automatically come from bhakti. But a devotee is simply satisfied with the service, and therefore he doesn't accept such liberations. And then the Lord points out that if a devotee doesn't accept these four types of liberations, then how would a devotee ever accept opulences, benedictions, that are within the province of time? Kala Viplutam. Happiness, opulence, wealth, that's finished by time. If a devotee is not going to accept the four types of liberations, he's never going to consider accepting anything within the clutches of time. So these verses give us some insight into the treasure, the Mahadana of a devotee. And naturally, we want to analyze our life and see how is the wealth doing. Calculating wealth is a pleasurable activity. We constantly want to look at our life and see how is the Mahadana there? How is it increasing? Or maybe it's decreasing. So for a devotee, our whole calculations are different. We want to see the wealth of Vaishnav Sangha. We want to see the wealth of attentive chanting of the holy name. We want to see the wealth of Vaishnav Seva. We want to see the wealth of distributing Krishna consciousness to others. In this way, our life is truly opulent. And we can be the wealthiest person from the material point of view, but without the Mahadana, our life is miserable. It becomes a grind, even despairing, even leading to depression. When I was speaking in Toronto, as well as at Long Beach, University of Long Beach, I explained about a survey done in Silicon Valley. In order to qualify for this survey in Silicon Valley, you had to have a house that was worth at least 1 million U.S. You had to have 1 million U.S. cold cash in the bank. And you had to have investments worth 1 million. So if you had those three things, you were included in this sociological study. And what did this research find out? That almost all such persons considered that they didn't have enough to be secure in this world. And they very eloquently and articulately explained why that's so. They said, you don't understand. This is not the 70s. What's $1 million these days? It's nothing. I saw, and there was some videos made of this, of interviews with persons, and a dinner table with the husband and wife and the children, and the husband and wife, they were explaining very sincerely, we're not rich. We are not rich. We just have enough for our family to get by. Seriously, sincerely, we are not rich. No, I don't consider that we are rich. The way the world is now, anything could happen. Anything could happen. They sincerely felt in that way, that they needed a few million more. Remember, a house worth $1 million. $1 million in investments, $1 million in cold cash. No, if we just had a few million more, then we could feel secure, but not in the way the world is right now. No. And then they would further defend themselves by saying, look, you have to understand, we're thinking about our family. It's not just for me, or it's not just for my wife, it's for the kids. We just need a few million more dollars. That was aspect number one. And then aspect number two was even more revealing. I said, and furthermore, you've got to understand where we live. You may think that we are wealthy, although we don't consider ourselves wealthy, but how do you think we feel knowing that across the street someone is worth $1 billion? Don't you understand we can't rest in peace? We're nothing. We're small-timers in this neighborhood. There are people worth $1 billion, several billion, right in the 10-minute drive of us. How do you think our kids feel? So they were working 70-hour weeks because they considered they didn't have enough to be secure and that they hadn't really made it yet. And they all are perfectly, from their point of view, emotionally rationalized it all, and were quite sincere about it. We are not rich. We're just getting by. I don't understand what it's like to have a family these days. So here we see that there's something about the material energy that no matter how much you get, you think you don't have enough. And this becomes a neurosis. Now you may say, well, the neurosis must start when you pass the $1 million mark. But for those of us who don't have such deep pockets and wherewithal, it's to be expected that we should be in anxiety. But speaking about stress and stress management, what was Prahlad Maharaj's analysis of how stress comes? When his father, Hiranyakashipu, picked him up, put him on his lap and smelled his head with affection. My dear boy, what is the best thing you learned in school today? Famous inquiry. And the five-year-old Prahlad said, Saru manye suryavarya dehina sadasa madvigya dhyamasagraha. Foremost of the materialists, here is the best thing I learned in school today. Anyone who identifies with the body as the self must always be in anxiety. Always be in anxiety. So it's not about wealth reducing anxiety. It's about reducing the bodily conception of life, and then the anxiety reduces. So you can see in the Silicon Valley study, other research brings out that increased affluence doesn't mean that You'll have increased peace of mind. Poorer people are in anxiety, rich people are in anxiety. Maybe it doesn't have something to do with the money. Maybe it has more to do with the bodily conception of life. Therefore, our focus on the Mahadhana, the supreme treasure in life. The more of the Mahadhana we have, the less we'll endeavor on the material platform. And automatically we're peaceful because of that. The pleasure of devotional service means simply thinking how to please Krishna's senses. We'll talk about that in the second part of our discussion. Third part. Right now we're going to go into the middle. We finished part one. Now the middle. The yoga of money. This is a subject I've just begun to speak about. So I'm speaking from some notes. Some sutras. Don't mind. When we speak about the yoga of money, we are speaking about relationship. Yoga always means relationship. So, how is our relationship with money? This is a very crucial part of life, not only for the persons who are not practicing Krishna consciousness, but also, of course, for the Krishna conscious persons. They have to deal with money. So, what about our relationship with money? We think about getting money, giving money, using money, or we even think about money by avoiding to think about it. I don't think about money at all. Some or other are always in relationship with money. So let's examine that yoga. We should look at it, because often money is a very strange, troubled, yet wonderful part of our lives sometimes. It's wonderful. Often it's strange and troubled. It affects relationships with other persons. It affects relationships with our near and dear ones. It affects our relationships with society. Now, the yoga of money recognizes that we can use our relationship with money as a gateway to transform our whole life, since it plays such an important role in our existence. So rather than live in denial, well, I never think about money, or it's nothing to us. Or rather than going to the other extreme and just being fully money conscious, absorbed, why not recognize the potency and reality of the money relationship and use it in yoga for transforming our whole life? It's very practical. Generally, when it comes to money matters, we feel very conflicted. Internal upheavals. We feel very uncertain. And we just don't feel wholesome and peaceful about it. Money matters, money matters. What to do? So the yoga of money recognizes that if we can redesign our relationship with money, that'll be the key to transforming our whole life. Please focus on that point. And think about how you could do it in your own life. Rather than just be in denial of money and, no, we're beyond that, been there, done that, or we really have to worry about that. You don't understand right now, it looks like a recession, and, you know, we've been caught in the wrong business or in the wrong occupation, and of course, tonight, I'm not going to speak about budgeting or financial planning. You don't expect that to hear that from a sannyasi. No, I'm going to talk about how to live in a proper yoga relationship with money. Let's look at the various emotions that we feel relating to money. There's fear. Oh no, we don't have enough of it. We pretend. Oh, it's not important in this house. Oh no, we're just not concerned with money matters. I don't know how many of you fall into each category. And then there's the complete embracal. Money is the honey. Money can't buy you everything, it's true. But what it can't buy, it can rent. Also, we should notice, in terms of our physiology, the effect that money has on our heart. It really, you know, it could cause, you know, it can quicken our heartbeat when there's some impending loss. It can quicken our heartbeat when there's some impending gain. It really can put us on the edge of our seats, you know. So it's such a powerful thing in our life. We should not leave it outside the domain of the Krishna conscious spotlight. So let's face it head on and talk about the yoga of money. When we look at our lives, we see that often, especially in terms of our working life, there's an annoying, aching disconnect between the life we imagined for ourselves and the way life has turned out. Like, for example, in terms of that, in terms of just the workplace existence. Like, Adam was telling me, oh, the boss I have now, oh. The one I had before was great, now the boss I have now. I mean, you know, I'm just not a good pretender. I just don't know if I can just fake it and just, you know, put on a front that I, you know, that I can tolerate, you know, is being so obnoxious. So then you start to feel this pain in the heart that, is this the life that I imagined for myself? I imagine myself to be a wholesome, balanced person with wholesome, balanced circumstances. And, you know, I chant Hare Krishna, associate with devotees, and just everything would just proceed merrily, holistically, kindly. And now, for 40 hours a week, or whatever time one's working, part-time, less, now during this time at the workplace, I just have to act in such a way that I never expected I would have to act. It's just not the life that I imagined for myself. Always this pressure. Earn more. Buy more. Save more. Have more. There just never seems to be enough of the money. And then what you have to go through to get the money. I don't know. I didn't think this was going to be the way my life would turn out to be. So this ache, there's an aching often in the core of our heart that, like, I've got to sell myself, you know, abandon my highest aspirations, abandon my most profound conceptions of myself just to get money. And then you, oh, I had enough of those thoughts. Look, you know, the mortgage has to be paid, the rent has to be paid, you know. Soon the kids are going to need to go to university, and just got to buckle down, keep the nose on the grindstone. But, this is just not the way I expected my life. This is not how I expected it would turn out. So, it's a fact that even for devotees, it's difficult to escape the powerful push and pull of money. Everyone reacts to its ups and downs. So once again, let's face it. We need to understand our yoga relationship with money. Just like food, I also speak on the yoga of food. Now, everyone who's practicing Krishna consciousness knows how prasad plays such an important role in the home and in social gatherings. So, and as Prabhupada once said, he quipped that this is the kitchen religion. Also, in terms of, for example, India, so Prabhupada once commented that the happiness of Indian family life is eating. So we're all quite up to speed when it comes to yoga food. Looking at Saratma, I remember a splendid meal I had at his house with Naranjan Swami. So food is like that amongst devotees. Just looking at him, I remember a meal. So that shows how intense the yoga connection is. Remember that part?
Yes, I'm glad you're a vegetarian.
So, when it comes to money, though, other feelings come to us, and it's not so resolved. That's my point. The money reality is not so resolved. The food reality, we really have down. So therefore, I thought this subject, yoga money, would be interesting for you all. Let's think. The reality is that money not only has the power... let me put it another way. Money has the power that we assign to it. And practically speaking, whether we're bhakti yoga practitioners or not, it oftentimes we have given money an immense power of attorney over our life. And we don't like it, we'd rather not talk about it, you know, but it just seems to be the way it is. Often we can look at our life and see that money has become more important than us. It crowds out all the space in our existence. And then we say, I don't have time for the Mahajana. I don't have time for the treasures. Krishna, Krishna's service and love of Krishna. Practically speaking, how do I deal with that? What we're saying then is, practically speaking, because of the time required to get money, I don't have time for the supreme treasure, and that's the way it is. And is there any alternative? You know the question. What will a human not do for money? Human beings will enslave other human beings. They'll enslave their own self. They'll kill. They'll destroy the environment. Here's an example I gave at in Mumbai, at the most prestigious nuclear research facility in India, the Baba Institute of Nuclear Research. Maybe some of you are familiar with it. I've heard it's about like 20,000 or so nuclear researchers gathered in this enclave outside of Mumbai. They have the dormitories, the institute, and then right on the shore, they have underground bunkers with the nuclear research facilities. So, I was just, there were about 30 persons gathered in a program we did there. And so we discussed handling nuclear energy and Krishna consciousness. First, I pointed out to them what they already knew, the difficulties with nuclear energy as a power source. Number one, what do you do with the radioactive waste? Number two, even if you say that you have devised proper safety methods, those safety methods are applied by human beings. And human beings are part of a human society. And so there's so much room for error. And a third reason I didn't say, but they're finding out in the southwest USA now, is that there's not enough water to operate in nuclear power plants. They may have to shut down in the Southwest because nuclear power plants require huge amounts of water. So I said to these scientists, even if you solve all those problems, you haven't dealt with the human factor in terms of human beings and their inability to control their mind and senses. They kind of looked, they looked at me puzzled. Well, I mean, we think we know what we're doing. They basically were saying, you know, they were shooting those vibes at me. Swamiji, we think we have it together. And why do you think we've all gathered here to study at this sublime research institution? We can handle it, Swamiji. Progress is being made. Of course, they wouldn't say that, you know, but they could feel the vibe shooting out, you know. So, I said, all right, I know what you're thinking. Let me give you a true story. Did you know that the world's most profitable corporation, ExxonMobil, I think last year, every year they're breaking their profit record. What's it up to now? $50 billion clear profit?
That is in trillion.
No, no, billion. Clear profit. Clear profit in 1 year. Clear profit in 1 year. It's up to about $50 billion now for last year. Clear profit. So, ExxonMobil has admitted that they have a very nice slush fund of a mere $10 million for... how shall we say, encouraging scientists who would indeed see that the global warming theory, it's a theory, is not quite all it's presented to be. How do they put it when they were asked about it? They said, no, we're not trying to at all do anything underhanded. It's just that we'd like to hear from scientists who can show that, you know, there's still a lot that's not understood about global warming, and we shouldn't become fanatical, and there's probably, you know, some faults, and we just want to highlight those issues, and therefore, we've simply offered encouraging stipends of, for the first essay, $50,000. And we take it from there. So it's no way is this any kind of corruption. It's just encouraging academic research to be well balanced. So the researchers at the Mova Institute for Nuclear Research, they're looking at, okay, yeah, ExxonMobil, yeah, we know. Of course, you know, we know these things go on. I mean, happens in India all the time. What's wrong with it? Why shouldn't it happen in other places, you know? And then I said, oh, well, let's bring it on home here. What would you do when ExxonMobil knocks on your door? Says, $50,000 for the first essay. Yeah. Even though you know it would compromise your research, even though you actually feel... you're dead against whatever they're doing or whatever they want you to present. Still, $50,000 just for the first essay. And then after that, it goes on up. I looked at them. What would you do? They just all looked down. I said, who here would turn them down? Again, they looked. And furthermore, yeah. What would happen if you told your wife about it? What would she say? You might think of refusing slightly, but what if you talked though with your wife? She'd have that $50,000 spent already. There's no value judgment implied in this, you know, practical, right? Right? Ladies have to keep an eye on the household affairs and the future education of the children and all these kind of things and taking care of the mother and, you know, so, you know. And here's the man, you know, being a bit idealistic and so scientific, but you know, what about the bills? You know, what about the, you know, maybe a bigger home is needed. You know, these are all important things. So again, I say no value judgment. Just this is the reality. Okay, so you know, what do you think your wife would say, even if you hesitated? Again, everyone looks down at the floor. So here's an example how we'll do what's necessary. That's what we call it. We'll do what's necessary because of money. And never mind, it's destroying the environment. Still, what must be done must be done. So, in other words, what we're saying is that instead of money providing a life of genuine freedom, joy, and clarity, instead the money dictates the whole show of our life. And we feel uncomfortable about that, especially as devotees. We hear discussions by swamis about having the focus to hear your rounds without your mind chattering away. And we say, oh, it sounds like a distant dream sometimes. I go, oh, yeah, that's really nice. But we hear, you know, about reading Prabhupada's books. We hear about coming together as much as possible for Vaishnava Sangha. But we know that there's a certain reality that has to be faced. Money is so powerful, it affects our most intimate relationships. It's not simply a question of the workplace. It's not simply about our friends. It's also about our immediate family and even our romantic affairs. Money has an enormous role. Amongst kind of well-moneyed, generation after generation, financially entrenched families in America, they have a statement, especially it was quite prevalent in the 20th century. Now they have a lot of new wealthy persons, but the old families, wealthy families, quite a few of them, I went to a prep school with their children, DuPonts, Rockefellers, like that. And I could see that my schoolmates, their families weren't happy. And often the families were put together. Marriages were made based on class and just, how do we say, not a marriage of convenience, but a marriage of joining assets and wealth. One of my schoolmates told me, he's from the DuPonts, and his mother explained her relationship with his father. She had a very simple marriage. A very simple mantra. A very simple mantra was, marry the money, love comes later. You know, she married the wealthiest man she could find. Her parents were happy about that. It increased their family's prestige. Now she married into the DuPonts. And the love, well, we'll worry about that later. Marry the money, love comes later. Then my own mother, when I was 5 years old, taught me a mantra, which I never had a chance to use, that she married carefully. Ingrained this mantra in me. Son, remember one thing. When you get older, you know, romance without finance is a nuisance.
Ha, 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 ha
What a dominating role money plays, even in our intimate affairs. As teenagers, I remember, in Upper Manhattan, New York City, some of the guys kind of swaggering around, presenting their policy. First, I look at the purse. Gotta sing a song. A woman can be as fine as she can be, with lips as sweet as honey, but that doesn't mean a thing to me if she's got no money. If the purse is fat, that's where it's at. She can be riddled with a rash as long as she's got some cash. First I look at the purse. So this is the reality. This is how much money dominates even our intimate relationships. And it not only your financial status assigns value to yourself in your own eyes, but of course in the eyes of society. So then there's another part which is uncomfortable for me to present. Privately, let's think. In the course of our trying to push on our financial affairs, who has not demeaned, devalued, or debased themselves, taken temporary leave of their own personal principles because of you had to do something to keep or get or maintain money? And we don't like to look at these things, and I don't want to take too much time about this, but it's there. Even we've taken advantage of others or done things, in short, that we're not proud of in terms of our inner principles. Because, I'll give an example. I was visiting my relatives, some of them in Michigan, and my brother-in-law, has his PhD in dental research, something like that. And he's been given a research grant by the University of Michigan. And he has research assistants. So he was just explaining to me, and he's a very deeply ethical man in terms of deeply entrenched Christian morals. Very contributing member in all ways. His church community works closely with his minister and just takes the Christian ethics, as known in this country, takes it very seriously. But even he just was saying to me, the word came down that there may be a cut for our funding. So, I've already, told my research associates that if there's any cut in the funding, who's going to go? It's not me, it's you guys. and so I just looked at him, and I could see he felt uncomfortable with that, but at the same time, he felt justified. Well, that's the way it is. Ultimately, you've got to look out for number one. You've got to do what you got to do. I've got a family, I've got kids in college, when it comes down to it, if there's going to be a cut in funds, certainly I'll release these these researchers, these grad student researchers. My salary can't be touched. So he felt a little embarrassed, but at the same time, that's the way it is. We're going to talk more about that later. The resignation, that's the way it is. It plays a prominent role in our lifestyle. So in short, we can see that money issues scar rich families, and it scars, money issues scar poor families. Poor families often disrupted in complete anxiety. They don't have money to live. But rich families are also scarred by money. Rivalry, jealousy, fights over inheritances. Another example, I told in L.A., those of you who were in class there heard it. It's a true story from Ukraine. It happened last year. There was a devotee in a small town. Well, I mean a city about, I guess, the size of Santa Barbara. Santa Barbara is considered a city, yes? Okay, so about that size. And he had an okay relationship with his mother. He was 35, so he hadn't lived at home in like, you know, maybe almost close to 20 years. But, you know, nice relationship with mom. And then his father died, and his father left him in his will as an inheritance a one-bedroom apartment. Now, in Ukraine, a one-bedroom apartment. Anyone here from Ukraine? Right, I mean, a one-bedroom apartment. This is like, you know, you inherited a house in, what is it, Montecito?
Montecito.
Yeah, it's like, a one-bedroom apartment. Ordinary one-bedroom apartment. You have made it. So, a whole family dispute erupted. The mother and this devotee's uncle wanted to give it to the daughter of the uncle. And so things quickly got very nasty. His own mother became his opponent. And they took it to court, you know, how to illegally deprive him of his inheritance. The devotee wanted to use the apartment for like a preaching center in his city, because that was the only hope that devotees would ever have, as you know, in the near future, to get a center. And so that was his motivation. But his mother was fighting it in court that he shouldn't get his inheritance. It's not that she didn't like it, that he was, it's not about, you know, he's going to use it for Krishna consciousness. No, she just wanted it. They wanted it for their own purposes. She would have fought him no matter what he wanted to use the flat, the apartment for. So, Ukraine, justice means whoever pays off the judge the most. So, you know, the mother is bribing the judge, so the devotee also had to bribe the judge, and, you know, whoever, you know, comes up with the highest bid at the time of the decision, you know. That's the way it is in that part of the world. Like in Russia, I know one devotee who's a criminal prosecutor. You know, just like we have DAs or federal prosecutors here. So I asked him, is it possible that there can be a court decision without paying? He looked at me and said, it happens sometimes. It happens sometimes. So as prosecutor, it's simply his job to arrange bribes. He goes back and forth between the accused and the judge, and they arrange a pay. That's his job. And so it's really depressing for him, because never mind that he studied law in school, you know, for 6 years or whatever, you know, that's just to give you the paper, the certificate, and then you're a qualified bribe arranger. It's not about you know, legal knowledge and legal philosophy. It's just all about currying bribes. So, that's the way it is. So anyway, it was neck and neck between the mother and her son. One court case after another, and so finally, one day the mother, this happened last year, the mother called him on the phone and said, let's make peace. You know, this has really been really bad for the family. I mean, we're all acting horribly just over this financial gain. Come over to my house and I'll invite your uncle and we'll have a loving family meal. So the devotee went over, I mean, his own mother, and Normally, he was a very strict devotee, so he wouldn't eat food cooked by non-devotees, not even by his own mother. But for this situation, he's thinking, you know, for Krishna's service. And his mother was very cordial, and let's make peace, and Uncle Bob here, he feels bad about what he's done, and we've all just lost our heads in this, in pursuit of this financial gain. I'm really ashamed, you know, how I've treated my own son. The mother even had his special copper water pot from India. Yeah, yeah, he was pukka. So only drink water out of a copper water pot, especially from India. And so the mother was, you know, serving him water in that, you know, just doing everything his way. What was going on? In the water were psychological drugs to derange his mind. In the food was poison. He drank the water, and then immediately his head started to spin. He had already taken some bites of food, and you know, his stomach, he was like about to explode. He just fell on the floor, writhing in pain. And his mind is spinning. He's writhing in pain on the floor from the poison. And his own mother and his own uncle are on top of him, beating him. Die! 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 You'll never get this apartment! Die! Die! Take this! Now you see what happens! Die! His own mother. Well, he was taken to the hospital. He didn't die. And he amazed the doctors by recovering in just a week. There was no point, of course, pressing charges against the mother and the uncle because they had already paid off the police. And so then he told me this whole story to ask me, should he push it further? Because he'd have to pay a little more money to the judge, and we should just walk away and be detached. And we discussed, and we both concluded, because it was for Krishna's service, and he had a very, very good chance of winning, and he still had some money, you know, left to pay the judge off. And so he went on with it, and indeed he finally won the case. I asked him, how's mom doing? And she says she's practically gone crazy. She's just lost her mind, like, you know. After doing such a horrible thing, she's really just mentally deranged. So this is what money does. This is a graphic example. Now, of course, we would never do anything so extreme as that. But sometimes we wonder, what happened to that very soulful, spiritual person that we knew ourselves to be? Suddenly we're forced into situations in which money dominates. Money is the number one criterion. In other words, we have our internal image of ourselves, our conception of ourselves, and then there's what we have to be in order to get money. So in other words, money has suddenly transported us to a completely different playing field. And we don't like it. It makes us feel bad in our hearts. It makes us lose our self-respect, and we all have to do things we normally wouldn't do, compromise ourselves, be a bit callous toward others, to look out for yourself. So this is the situation. I'll just jump over here. In Toronto, I explained some points about, for example, Adam Smith, the father of capitalism, and the difference between his world and our world now. maybe.
That sounds important.
Okay. Okay. Adam Smith's world was very different. As you all know, he came up with the philosophy that the invisible hand of self-interest would produce the best for society. Self-interest through the free market system would somehow make it so that the best would always emerge. So now, because of the havoc in the world, this is starting to be known as free market fundamentalism. People are starting to think there needs to be something else, but they don't know what. They've tried socialism. That was a failure. The only thing they know is just capitalism. So the question is, how bridled should the capitalism be? Because it's obvious the free market fundamentalism is, especially now what's happened in the USA with the credit crunch. It's obvious that just leaving the invisible hand of self-interest through the free market to produce the best for society is just not working out. But let's look at the world of Adam Smith a couple of hundred years ago. It was very different from our world now. Back then, during Adam Smith's time, there was slavery in so many places, there was sex discrimination, there was racism, there was colonialism. And the world was quite, the chunks of the world were very separated from each other. There was continental Europe, but then way over on the other side was, North America, way over on the other side was Asia. Everything was just separate. Now what do you have? You have global interconnectedness. Politically, ecologically, everyone's recognizing we're all living in the same hotel room in terms of the environment. So this understanding that just act for your financial self-interest, you'll act for your financial self-interest, I'll act for my financial self-interest, and somehow or other, the best will always emerge. It's not working out in today's world of interconnectedness. So next, and finally, I go to the point about myths. There are quite a few myths underlying the social level of the money problem. So if we're going to talk about the yoga of money, we have to get to the underlying social myths. And these myths can easily be dispelled by Krishna conscious knowledge. Om Purnamada Purnamida. The Supreme Absolute Truth is perfect and complete. And because the Supreme Absolute Truth is perfect and complete, whatever emanates from the Supreme Absolute Truth is also perfect and complete, even this material world. And then the next verse, that you're entitled to take from resources as much as you need to live a spiritual life. Nothing more. If you live like this, you can go on working for ages. Everyone's entitled to their quota. But if you don't understand the purpose of life, you'll never understand what your quota is. If you don't understand what the Mahadhana is, the supreme treasure, you'll never be able to rein yourself in and check your desires for unnecessary expansion, unnecessary acquisition. Without understanding what the goal of human life is, it's not possible to then judge properly your relationship with the energies of this world, more accurately, the energies of the Supreme Absolute Truth. So therefore, we find a certain paranoia. There's just not enough. The world is deficient. This is an underlying anxiety. And therefore, everyone has a fear they're going to be losing out. There's not enough jobs. There's not enough grant money at the university. There's not enough resources, not enough oil. There's not enough gas. So in the back of the mind is always this conception of scarcity. Now it's true, there's not enough based on the way people are living. But if you look at the Isha Upanishad, we see Om Purna, Adat Purnamita. There is enough if we would live life according to the wishes of the source of all the energy. But there's not enough when we forget the purpose of life and freestyle and just do our own thing. Forgetting Krishna, we become full of fear. and the practicable manifestation of that forgetting Krishna. And fear is that we always think there's not enough, therefore we are justified to do such and such, because there's not enough. This fear that there's not enough becomes so noble and enshrined in our heart that it, you'll recognize this, it becomes like, well, you've got to take care of your own. You got to do what you got to do to take care of your family, take care of yourself. In a world of scarcity, there's just not enough. Everyone nods their head. Yeah, yeah. This reminds me of, maybe some of you played this game as little kids. Maybe you played it. Musical chairs? Yeah. What's it like? What happens in the game?
If you have two people, you need one chair, and then whoever sits in one of the chairs, then they're the winner.
Yeah. And what happens? The music stops, right?
Yeah.
And then there's not enough chairs for everyone. So whoever sits in the chair first is the winner, and whoever doesn't is the loser. So this is our mentality when it comes to looking at the world. Since there's not enough, when the music stops, I want to be in that chair. I'm not just doing it for myself, I'm doing it for my family, my children. I know there are other children, other families in the world, but you know, in a world of scarcity, you just got to do what you got to do. Everyone nods their head. Yeah. So you see this kind of paranoia that warps your finer qualities. It all becomes acceptable as just the way it is. Just like my brother-in-law would say, well, if there's going to be any cutting of the grant money for our research, you know whose job is going to go before mine. I'm letting my staff go. I'm not touching my salary. Praise the Lord. So, due to our faulty lifestyles, individually and collectively, there's this paranoia. There's just not enough, and therefore we're justified to be the way we are. Myth number two is, more is better. If having something is good, having more of that thing is even better. If one car is good, two cars are better. Right? If three rooms in the house are good, six rooms are better. Right? It's amazing how deeply this is ingrained in us. And this is why market researchers are able to entice you with, I'm sure you all can remember being in these situations. You go to a supermarket, let's say, to buy a tube of toothpaste. And then you see the sign, buy two, get the third one free. Now, you know that you only need one tube of toothpaste or one box of laundry powder. But you can't resist that the third one's going to be free. I'll buy two, I'll get the third one free, free, free. So the market researchers have the psychology down. They know that you want to feel like you've scored, you've gotten a bargain, you've got something free. But even though you don't need more than one, just the fact that you're going to get something free just blows your mind, and you just have to surrender. This is, of course, we understand this is the nature of conditioned existence. We come to this world looking for profit, as explained in the fifth canto, the forest of material enjoyment. But we can't resist something that's free, even though we actually don't need it. So why not? I'll buy two. I'll get the third one free. And you go home and tell your husband or wife, look at this. The third one was free. Even though you don't need. You just needed one. But the whole concept of getting something for nothing is irresistible. So there is myth number two. More is better. And it's amazing how insidious this myth is woven into our lives. Now, bear in mind that we'll, of course, I explained this point to a non-devotee audience. I say to them, none of you will consider yourselves as materialists. They all nod their head. The materialists are always those who have more than you. Everyone, yeah, they are the materialists, the ones who have more than us. We just have just what we need. But those others, they're the materialists. Yeah. So in this way, we never take a deep look at our life. Of course, as devotees, we understand the definition of materialism is really not wealth-bound. It's about the bodily conception of life. As Prahlada Maharaj said, sadasama vigya dhyama sakrana. As long as you identify the body as a self, you'll always be in anxiety, and that's the definition of materialist, to think that you are a product of matter. And the Bhagavatam explains that once you think yourself a product of matter, then you identify with the transformations of matter, and that's the story of your material existence. Okay. Myth number three, this is the resignation. Well, this is just the way it is. This is the way the world is. You know, we can't change it, we don't like it, but you know, you gotta live in it, and you know, you got children, you got a family, so you know, what can you do? This is just the way things are. You just gotta leave it at that, you know? What's the point of being idealistic? We didn't make this world the way it is. We gotta live in it, so you just gotta do the best you can. So the yoga of money wants to cut through all those myths and get to the heart of the issue. Redefine our relationship with money, first of all, by recognizing what is the Mahadhana, the supreme treasure. And then we won't be so attached to the so-called treasures that are Kala Vibhuta, under the rule of time, finished by time. Once we have the Mahadhana, Krishna, Krishna's service, and love of Krishna, then we can easily deal with financial resources. But as long as we're looking at those resources as our sense of self-worth and the way we express ourselves and provide ample security in this world. Just like many of you have heard the expression, retail therapy. When you feel bad, you go out and shop. This is expensive. I have seen that it's much easier to design and live a simple lifestyle if you have the Mahadhana than without. Because without having something positive, it's very difficult to cut back on attachments to material life. So, the more we actually increase our acquisition of the Mahadhana, the three things, the easier it is to deal with the temporary treasures. They don't seem to be so intimidating in importance anymore. And then we can fully face the yoga of money. We can face money and define our relationship. Okay, this is needed, this much is needed. It's not going to take our heart, though. We can redefine our relationship with money very easily when we have some other treasure in our accounts. So in that way, Krishna consciousness is very practical. Next, I'm not going to do it tonight, but I would go into a whole subject about using money in a way that liberates our hearts by helping others. As devotees, we are interested in others becoming Krishna conscious. Using money to give ourselves Krishna consciousness, and then using money to give others Krishna consciousness. This would be more in my spiritual economics lecture. And I was explaining to Giriraj Maharaj how last year at the University of Toronto's Business School, Rotman School of Business and Management, one of the top 20 business schools in the world, we were invited to speak there on the subject of spiritual economics. And so the university business school thought that, you get about 25 students, interesting subject matter. And so they allotted a seminar room about the size of this room. Then 3 days before the event, they called up and said, "Do you realize that there are 150 RSVPs for this talk?" So they put us in their most swank auditorium, very posh, where the CEOs of General Electric and IBM and General Motors speak there. They put me on the stage, and above my head was the stock market ticker flashing all the prices, latest prices. And so we chanted Hare Krishna and spoke about spiritual economics using economic development, work, using money to give yourself spiritual advancement and then to give spiritual advancement to others. And they all felt this was very practical. I told them that you can redefine your whole relationship to your work if you see it as an opportunity to give yourself a Krishna-conscious environment and give others a Krishna-conscious environment. Of course, I would use the word spiritual consciousness interchange with Krishna consciousness. I wasn't going to not mention Krishna. I didn't go to all that trouble to go to such a place, and not use the word Krishna. And I definitely presented the chanting of Hare Krishna. I was telling Guru and Swami how some of the devotees were a little nervous about that. Maharaj, are you going to have us chant Hare Krishna in this kind of place? And in fact, a few of the devotees were students at the university, so they're like, One of the devotees who led the chanting, we packaged it nicely. They were dressed as ordinary students. She was a disciple of Naranjan Maharaj. She was finishing her master's in microbiology, like that. And the devotee playing the mridanga had already graduated from the university there and was doing market research. So I just introduced him in that way. Here are some of your own. And they're just going to lead us into this mantra meditation, since the subject of the lecture is spiritual economics. Never enough. Fair enough. So, in that lecture, I explained how we should make an economy of giving, not getting. So that can apply to the yoga of money also. How to live so we can give. Give to ourselves, Krishna consciousness. Give the Mahadhana to ourselves and give it to others. Then we feel much better about our work endeavors. And that's practical. You can put up with a lot at work knowing that I'm doing this to give myself a Krishna conscious home, a Krishna conscious family, and to help others be Krishna conscious. That Mahadhana, the real treasure, is there. And so therefore, it's easy to handle other things. In conclusion, I want to discuss the glories of devotional service, since that's the treasure. There's no question of Krishna or love of Krishna without devotional service. That treasure of devotional service is so... nothing surpasses it. And examples of that I'd like to give are stated in Chaitanya Charitamrita in terms of Sri Daruka, Krishna's chariot driver, and Krishna's dearmost devotee, Srimati Radharani. The Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami explains that devotees will deride ecstasy from devotional service if it interferes with devotional service. It's a very astounding concept. to derive ecstasy, legitimate Krishna conscious ecstasy, if it interferes with your service. But this is the standard of pure devotion. Let's look at the example of Sri Daruka. Both these examples are quoted from, they're in Nectar of Devotion, Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, Rupa Goswami, has these verses there, and they're quoted in Chaitanya Charitamrita. In the case of Sri Daruka, we have the situation of Anga Stambharambam. He, while fanning Krishna, felt his limbs of his body, his Anga, to be entering this stage of being stunned in ecstasy. Because of that, he purposely checked himself and did not relish. The verse says he didn't relish Supremananda, the bliss of ecstatic love of Krishna, because he felt it was interfering with his service. Just think, Supremananda, if I only had that. And here Sri Daruka will not relish it because he sees it's interfering with his service. This is something extraordinary. And then we turn to the example also given in Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu and Chaitanya Charitamrita in the case of Srimati Radharani. She's described as Aravinda Vilochana, lotus-eyed Srimati Radharani. It's not simply that she didn't relish the Premananda. The Shastra says she powerfully condemned it. This is the topmost devotee. She powerfully condemned the ecstatic love because her eyes were flooding with tears, and that was inhibiting her service. Just see the standard that we're dealing with in bhakti. This is how intense the prema dana, the treasure of love of Krishna, is. We will not, in our pure state, allow even Premananda to interfere with our service to Krishna. And Kaviraj Goswami describes the gopis in their expertise at this. They had no conception of their own happiness. They never served Krishna for their own happiness, yet they were more happy than Krishna, because Krishna forced happiness on them. Their happiness is always indirect, dependent on Krishna's happiness. And in that indirect happiness, they were more happy than Krishna. This is the mystery of bhakti. Of course, then Krishna comes as Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and tastes the gopi bhava. So, and that way Krishna is always the supreme enjoyer. But in as Krishna in his relationship with the gopis, although the gopis never think of their own pleasure, they're tasting the supreme pleasure. Their happiness is to see that Krishna is happy by looking at them. When they see Krishna is happy by looking at them, they become happy. And their happiness then nourishes Krishna's happiness further. So it's a complete efficient loop here. There's not one trace of selfishness in it. Their happiness originated because Krishna's happy. And their happiness, it's not something that just is their own thing. It 100% contributes to Krishna's further happiness. So it just goes around like that. And the competition is eternal. So Prabhupada describes this delicate competition. I really like that way you put it. Delicate competition. So it's always good for us to discuss the depths of the supreme treasure, the Mahadana. All right. We've covered a lot of subjects tonight. was inspired by Maharaj's presence. I wanted to share these discussions with you. Which, and these discussions, of course, could be the subject matter for a long seminar, but... Should I ask if there are any questions?
Just one point. At the beginning, you mentioned that you were going to speak about Mahakrodha.
Ah, thank you. Yes. This is described in Chaitanya Charitamrita that a devotee, and that those words are used, Mahakrodha, a devotee becomes angry when ecstasy interferes with his service.
Oh. Wow.
That word is actually used by Kaviraj Goswami, Mahakrodha, topmost anger at ecstasy. This is like a real foreign concept to our conditioned stage of life, you know. Glad you, thank you for remembering that. Yes.
We can take questions.
All right.
A rare opportunity to increase our wealth.
Maharaj, I want to thank you. That was a wonderful lecture. I was thinking of another myth that I carry with me, and that is that if I were more wealthy, then spiritual life would be easier because I don't know what I believe about it, but somehow I imagine wealthy people have more free time because other people are doing things for them, whether it's taking care of their car or their property or whatever it is. And I think that a parallel to that is, well, a sannyasi has it easy because they have servants and disciples taking care of them to provide sort of a buffer zone, you know, that allows them, this is just my imagination, of course, that allows them so much more free time to really dedicate to practicing their spiritual life.
As they shoulder the karmic reactions from the disciples, they're accepted. And try to keep healthy amidst all that. Well, I already explained to you how you never, materially, you'll never feel that you have enough wealth. It's just not the way Maya works. There's nothing in the material energy that tells you you've had enough. Psychologists are now doing research that backs up so many statements in the Bhagavatam about material illusion. The distress that you get from material life always is more significant than the happiness you get. They've made a phrase that good feelings satiate and bad feelings escalate. So whatever good feelings you have soon will be you'll feel satiated, like the buzz wears off, the thrill is gone. But whatever bad feelings you have just go on increasing. They're much more significant in your consciousness. So you'll never feel satisfied materially that you have enough. There'll always be material desires, the pangs. I really like that word Prabhupada uses, the pangs of material existence. You know, like on a fast day, you get hunger pangs. Well, you know, desires are, they come to you like that. You just have to have more. There's nothing in the material entity there's no built-in mechanism in the material entity that's going to tell you, that's enough now, you've had enough Maya. This is not the way it works. Well, if you can understand that point, you'll save yourself a lot of trouble. Yes.
In relation to what he was asking, I recently cook for some very wealthy people. Mm-hmm. And before I cooked for them, I used to also think that way, that, oh, they're so lucky that, you know, they have to work hard. But in the last 6 months of cooking for them and really getting to know them, those two families, they work so hard. They're like exhausted, and they have so much anxiety because their properties are so big, and this one particular woman, she just recently found out she became even more sick because she has so much anxiety because she has to take care of it. Like Maharaj was saying, to me that was like an awakening that actually there are more anxiety because they have more money. And I have very little money, and I don't have half their anxieties. You know, it's something I saw in my realization.
I'll give you an example I gave at the business school, University of Toronto. A survey done by the New York Times and CNN of children in affluent families. They found that more than 50% of these children felt that their lives were worse off than their parents because, they said, they were suffering from high expectations. Because my parents are wealthy and successful, I also have to be wealthy and successful. If I'm not, oh my God, it's the end of the world. And so they define their lives as less fortunate and less happy than their parents' lives, as they saw it. In other words, the higher the perch, the greater the fall. And that's what they were feeling. They said, there's just too much expectation these days, too many things you have to do. It's just too much. Our parents had it much easier. Yes.
Responding to what you said to Adam, if we don't have any way to know ourselves, like we're never satisfied, the senses are never satisfied, and yet we're allowed to accept a certain amount as our quota, and we can't trust ourselves to judge, like we should be satisfied, we should stop. So how is it clear? Because it seems that like one person seems to require more than another. So how do you make that determination? What is your quota actually?
There has to be Krishna consciousness. Otherwise you won't be able to see. And once you've actually tasted the wealth of bhakti, that gives you the experience to be able to compare to. Once you're tasting, just like we read from Chaitanya Charitamrita, to actually taste Krishna automatically as a byproduct, you're free from material existence. So if you actually taste Krishna bhakti, you've heard it often say, you've got to get a taste, booze, you've got to get a taste. And you might respond, well, I'm great, but I don't have the time to get a taste. I have seen, on every continent of the world, I have seen, where there's a will, there is indeed a way. Devotees who are serious about arranging their life to get a taste, so that they'll, a taste of Krishna consciousness, so they'll be able to shield themselves from unnecessary financial anxiety or unnecessary financial endeavors, they immediately look for guidance. They don't just go through this whole ordeal on their own. They look for successful Krishna conscious persons, householders to get advice from. They look, they don't mind taking advice from sannyasis. Yeah. They just look, they're just keen on advice. And I always see those devotees, they do quite all right. After all, Krishna does say in Bhagavad Gita that the whole bhakti process is it's just laden with seeking advice and guidance.
Prabhupada teach that one would take 50% of their income and dedicated to Krishna, and 50% or 25% for one's immediate needs, perhaps, and 25% for one's future needs. And like for most Americans, that would seem sort of impossible in a way. Like if you're kind of that struggling line. So is there something different about India's economics? Or is this meaning 50% of one's like profit, you know, after paying off one's living expenses and such?
There are different levels of commitment in Krishna consciousness. And also, time is money. A lot of devotees, they're using their time for cooking, for so many other services. In today's kind of society, in that time, they could have been out making money. But instead, they're donating their time. So I would say we have to look at that also in the current context. Look at the resources of your life and see. Yeah, look at your time, look at your money, look at your strength. What does the Bhagavatam say? Pranayar, artayar, diyavacha. Look at what's happening to your life energy, prana. Arta, your wealth. Diya, your intelligence. Vacha, your words. Okay?
Manaj, the sense of fearlessness that I've realized before and after trying to be Krishna conscious. But would it be the same when you're in different ashrams? How much would that ashram influence your fearlessness?
Your fearlessness?
Yeah. Because I no longer put those extra hours because I just want to sustain my job. I just get this feeling that Krishna will take care of me. So I just put in enough hours and try to do ashram service. And I've seen that I'm more peaceful. And I don't know if it's my karma, but I seem to be accumulating or getting money more than what I used to work before. But this fearlessness being single, would it sustain if I move into a different ashram?
I guess that depends on who you marry. Hopefully, you'll have a Krishna conscious marriage in which you won't have to be in so much anxiety about those things. It'll be there to some degree. As far as I can see, you know, a husband has to realize that part of his existence is to help the wife to feel secure. And ladies have a different vision of security than a man has, as far as I can see. Correct me if I'm wrong. So, you know, you have to take that on board. Understand what you're signing up for. Realistically speaking, it's you know, it's not that just. I mean, sometimes I see young men, you know, about to embark on marriage. They just, you know, they just have this vision. It's just, I'm just signing up for the sweetness and the, you know. And the ambrosial moods, the tenderness, the soft words. You have to see the whole package. I'm sure that there are many veteran expert householders here who could impart to you the Divya Gyan and reduce any hallucinations that you may have. I was talking to one very expert householder couple. They've been together 27 years, a godbrother and godsister, Badahari Prabhu and Kosharupa Mataji. And we were discussing how the UN just spent $15 million to research marriage around the world and problems of marriage. And they came up with a conclusion that the number one problem was too high expectations. So we were discussing this, Badahari, from Koshi Brahmaji, and they said, they could have just given any Krishna conscious householder the $15 million. We could have told them that was a conclusion. That would be the conclusion. That's what causes all the problems. Too high expectations. So you have to look at the dreams, look at the aspirations, and talk to some veterans and get a realistic understanding. And make a plan how to be Krishna conscious in that situation and make the home a Krishna conscious base. But there are going to be these differing visions of security. I mean, right now you may have, as you say, you may have one understanding of security. You've been living with, other men, It's easy living with other men, right? The house is dirty, who cares, If there's no food in the refrigerator, just go across the street to Govinda's and eat, right? But now you're embarking into another universe. So just keep that in mind. That's why our senior veteran Krishna conscious householders play such an important role. Anything else? Oh, it's getting a little late. I thank you all very much for your kind attention. Of course, maybe Maharaj would bless us with a few words of insight.
Just on that question of how you know when you've reached your limit, It's basically the same answer you gave, just a little point about it, and that is that you pay a price for everything. So if you're relishing the taste of Krishna consciousness, if you want to improve your material situation in order to have a better facility to practice Krishna consciousness, you're going to have to take some time out of your relishing of Krishna consciousness directly. And, that desire, to do what's favorable for your Krishna consciousness and, the mercy of the holy name, the mercy of the Lord within the heart, and people who can guide you, will help you define at what stage the price you're paying to increase your facility for Krishna consciousness is actually detracting from your relishment of Krishna consciousness. But without tasting Krishna consciousness, you won't have that standard by which to calculate. No. Just to give an example in a very simple context. I'm chanting at the beach and I'm relishing. But it's getting a little cold. I have a sweater next to me. But to put on that sweater, I have to stop chanting. That's going to detract from my relishing. And so I'll think, do I want to do that? Do I really want to stop chanting to become like a little more comfortable. And usually I put it off to a point, but then at a certain point, well, it's really getting cold, I'm gonna, you know, then I have to do it. So it's that type of calculation all the time in every sphere.